everybody. This is the Disciple Makers Podcast by discipleship.org. And this is your host, Dave Stovall. In this episode, Matt Dabbs talks with Todd Wilson for part two on their conversation about the challenges the American church faces in creating a culture of disciple making. If you didn't catch part one, skip back to episode 38 of this season to catch that before going any further. A national study shows that only 4% of churches have a disciple-making culture. Todd gives us insight as to why that is, focusing on the fact that churches with a lot of programs or their consumer-driven church actually hinders discipleship. We need a change in our church's operating system. Todd introduces six key elements that are crucial for establishing a new model that prioritizes relational disciple-making. Let's dive in and hear part two of this conversation between Todd Wilson and Matt Dabbs.
Hey, everybody. It's Matt at discipleship.org, and this is a follow-up with Todd Wilson, who was the founder of Exponential and is working with Renew Network as the directional team leader. And I just want to give you a little thumbnail about what we talked about in the previous session in case you haven't watched it or listened to it. I do encourage you to go back. I think when you hear what we're going to say in this one, you're going to want to go back and watch or listen to the first one. But we talked about the problem of the lack of disciple-making culture in American churches. National study came out, showed it was around 4% of American churches have a disciple-making culture. And really, Todd pointed out in the previous session that 16% is the tipping point. And so we're trying to figure out how to get churches to that 16% of churches to adopt disciple-making culture. And so there's some real issues there. That's a pretty significant hurdle to get to. And we talked about some of the causes being that the growth engine of much of what American churches are doing is that institutional programmatic time draw of everybody's volunteer time. And it's making disciple-making not the permission of the church. We're kind of driving other things are driving our growth. So that's the gist of what we were talking about with all of that. So just back up and zoom out a bit and look at what's it going to take to fix this? Is there a fix or some sort of solution for what we're talking about with all this?
So Matt, I think at the high level, I like to say to people, the more I look at this issue, the more, and I've really been a student practitioner here for years on trying to figure out how to break the code on this 16% thing. The current operating system of the church, the prevailing operating system of the church. You can put whatever title you want on it. I think in some ways, if I'm putting a label on the current operating system, it's the consumer-driven operating system. But a first step for any of us is like, what? It isn't just church operating system. What's the label we would functionally put on the current operating system of the church? And for me, it's somewhere in the realm of the programmatic driven one, the consumer driven one. And what I say to people is when you really go look under the hood of the current operating system, I'm going to use the word ornery. It is so ornery that it's almost impossible to get away from its pull. Like it's like quicksand. That if you can decide as a church, we're not going to do it anymore. We're going to do a different operating system than what we've got. And here's the challenge. In change management, most people will talk about there's revolutionary change, like the birth of our nation. People die. It's traumatic. There's a significant cost to change. Let's say it's like going from the Apple computer to the Windows computer, or the iPhone to the Android phone, or vice versa. But then there's evolutionary change that's more like going from version 11 of the software to 11.1. It's slow, it's methodical, if that makes sense. When we're talking about operating system, whatever it is, if your church decides we're not going to do that one anymore, we're going to do something different, you've automatically put yourself into revolutionary change, the category of it's painful, it's difficult, people aren't going to like it, there's a lot of sideways energy. And we're now talking about in church an operating system. We talked about this in the first part of our interview, We're talking about a current operating system that the very people that run the operating system are the biggest barrier to actually choosing and getting a different operating system in place. And I don't mean that because they're negative people or any, I just mean when your livelihood is rooted in the economic engine that fuels the programmatic institutional growth engine of the current consumer-driven or programmatic growth engine, your livelihood's based on that current operating system's financial model, you're going to be the barrier to seeing a different one get put into place. When I say it's ornery. It holds itself in place. And so your question, what's the solution to seeing the 4% of churches in a disciple-making culture move to 16%? I don't want to sugarcoat it for you. I don't see a pathway there with the current operating system of the church, the programmatic institutional operating system that's evolved over the last 30 years. We're going to have to see revolutionary change with new operating systems in place.
And I think that's good to recognize that the current system, it was an innovation. It's not like it's 2,000 years old.
That's right.
So we have permission to make adjustments. It's not gospel.
Yeah. And again, we talked in the last session about the idea that if, let's just take the church growth movement of the last 40 years. If we go back to the roots of the current American church growth movement, way back in its roots with McGavran and Bill Hybels and Billy Graham and Rick Warren, you go back to the early days of the different people involved in it. I'm even going to bring business people like Peter Drucker, the father of modern management, who has his hands in it. Okay. It's a well-intentioned group of leaders who wanted to see evangelism thrive and wanted to take us from stagnant, older, dying churches to a more culturally relevant, fresh paradigm expression. The right motives are there, but then there's, over the last 40 years, somewhere in there is a co-opting of that, of going from the right good intentions that are rooted in a disciple-making paradigm to we've co-opted it into the reality is you can grow a large, sustainable church without ever making disciples. I know that's crazy, but you can grow a large, thriving church without making disciples.
You said something I thought was even maybe more provocative is the word, but it stung a little bit. But I think it's true in the previous interview when you, or maybe it was right beforehand, I'm not speaking out of turn. I think you said something along the lines of you could adopt the right principles and practices that a non-Christian could execute on things and produce a certain result.
Because this, again, put whatever label you want on it, a consumer-driven model, a programmatic model, it is essentially a franchisable model. It's a model that if you go follow the formula, if you're a good communicator with an entrepreneurial skill set, there's a skill set that goes with the model, you actually don't have to be a Christian to go grow by our metric of success, a thriving, growing church. You can grow a growing church without being a Christian.
That actually happens. And often it's because the person's talked themselves out of Christianity at some point in time. They may not have started there, but that does actually happen.
And the reason it can happen and the reason it does happen is when disciple making is not relational disciple making, Jesus style, is not the core mission of the church or the core growth engine of the church, but it gets replaced with a mission, a functional mission of growing a large, sustainable church programmatically and institutionally. Everything I just described, if our goal and our mission and our life depended on growing a large, sustainable thing called a church, and we were going to do it programmatically and institutionally, I didn't even use the word Christian or disciple in what I just said. So just play with the words. You don't have to be a Christian to grow a large, sustainable church using programmatic institutional methods. Somehow this co-opting of the last 30 years took us from good intentions with good people to a result that's not about movement. It's not about the quality of the disciple being produced. It's about the size and sustainability of the church being started and grown.
You mentioned, go ahead, is there more there?
I was just going to say, so your question, what's it take to overcome? We're going to have to get back to this idea of the operating system. There's elements of an operating system that are, there's no way in the proper operating system to get away from 2,000 years of biblical history. It's not, we're not talking about let's throw away 2,000 years of biblical history in the way Jesus intended it. What we're talking about and what you just brought up is the fresh winds that blow in new seasons where people are trying fresh expressions of things. The last 40 years of the church growth movement have had some well-intentioned, good applications of things. Peter Drucker, the father of modern management, one of his most important books of all of his things as the father of modern management was his five most important questions your organization can ask. Question one, what's our core business? Question two, who's your customer? What do they value? How will you deliver it? And how will you know? Guess what? Bill Hybels and Rick Warren are both mentored by Peter Drucker. Go read the book, The Purpose-Driven Church, through the lens of Drucker's five questions and ask yourself how Saddleback Sam and Samantha came into existence. They're 35 years old with 2.5 kids with a certain debt, working a certain thing. That is what you call a customer orientation. Now, is that good or bad? If we go back to the actual forming of the church growth movement, McGavran, who's a missionary, the idea of we've got to really understand the people we're reaching, and with data and research and sociological impact, we're going to be more effective at reaching people evangelistically if we understand who it is we're reaching. So you can fuss all you want about, oh, it's a business practice of who's the customer. I would just say, change the word from customer. Who's the non-Christian we're trying to reach? Doesn't it make sense that we ought to have an approach that's, hey, if we're going into a community to start a church, let's understand who are the unchurched people that we're trying to convert. So we can throw darts at the business practice part, but you get the impact that a person like Peter Drucker has on the early church growth movement people, and they're all well-intentioned. Hey, we're evangelists. How do we reach people? This is great. This customer orientation, I'm going to call that a fresh wind. I don't know that in the first couple of centuries of Christianity, I don't know whether they were sitting around talking about who's our customer or who are the people we're trying to reach in our community, or were they just flat out trying to make disciples without any worry about what the customer orientation was. And you know what? I don't know that we, in this particular case, have to get totally paralyzed on whether they did or didn't. If the reality is we can reach more people in today's context by understanding demographically who they are because we have such a mixture of people, why don't we want to have a mechanism for doing that? But now, if in fact that intentionality in evangelism eventually gets co-opted to that instead of a relational disciple-making approach as the mission and the goal, it becomes about growing a large, sustainable church. You can see how that paves the way for the institutional programmatic approach to take over everything. And now you even lose the church planting part that falls out of it. Mm-hmm. It's no longer about the collective growth of a collection of churches that are being started. It's about the attendance of one church.
It's like the business model done for you. It's not a perfect illustration because, I mean, the big church does need people, does need you to volunteer and give up yourself and work alongside. But the idea is if the programs are all working correctly, then the church is going to get those people, right? Like you don't necessarily have to go out and get the people. If you volunteer in the children's ministry, then when the people do come, so you did your part, but it feels like relational discipleship is not a done for you ministry. It's you go learn the culture of your neighbor. If they're from some other country or something, like, that relationality is the contextualizing element.
Here's the insanity of it, Matt, that we just have to call it what it is. So let you and I just for a second take a 20-year, you and I are going to start a church together, and we're going to talk about what success look like in 20 years in this church we're going to start. And we start talking about option A. We want to have our primary measure be the total collective number of surrendered followers of Jesus, not decisions, but the total number of converts surrendered to the Lordship of Jesus across all of the churches that result from the one church we're starting. So our scorecard is the collective of all the people in those churches. And maybe you and I start dreaming that over 20 years, oh, how cool would it be over 20 years? We're focused on disciple making as the core. We're trying to get true biblical surrendered converts. Maybe God blesses us over 20 years with, pick the number, 20 church plants, 40 church plants, 100 church plants, whatever it is. And collectively, let's just say it's 20 church plants. Collectively, those 20 church plants have 20,000 people in them. Collectively. So we've not grown a single mega church. Every church in our collective with 20,000 is not a mega church, but we've got 20,000 people. So that's option A. Option B is, let's try to figure out how our one church can get 20,000 people in it over the next 20 years. Now, here's the insanity of the model. If you and I start in that path that we want 20,000 people in our one church, you and I in the current model would probably want to be full-time vocational. We got to get our salaries covered by tithes and offerings. And we look at the economic engine, forget 20 years in the future. How do we get the first year of this thing going? We want to be in full-time ministry with a full-time paycheck. Guess what's going to happen? We're not going to choose the path of a core growth engine being relational disciple-making Jesus style. It took him 3 years with 12. How are we going to fund our salaries for a year if we got to take 3 years to get 12 disciples? We're going to pick the institutional programmatic approach as soon as our paradigm of success is we need to start one church that's going to reach 20,000 people over the next 20 years. And we got to do it by starting with us as full-time vocational ministers. It's going to lock us into the current paradigm of institutional programmatic growth. And here's where the insanity really comes in. In the first option, where we start 20 churches, disciples who make disciples, who start churches that plant churches, there is the natural reproductive DNA that leads to multiplication in the church. The only way it comes is through relational disciple making Jesus way. It's the only reproductive way to get to what we're talking about. But if we go back to the other option, which is you and I are going to start a programmatic institutional church to get to 20,000 people, there's not been a program in the history of the world that's ever reproduced itself. Programs don't reproduce. So here's the deal. The leverage that comes in the path of let's make disciples who make disciples that plant churches, the leverage comes in Jesus-style relational disciple-making. If we jump back to this church we're going to start programmatically, institutionally, programs don't reproduce, they consume. Where does the leverage come from? How do we leverage getting from a church that's just starting to 20,000 over 20 years in it? Volunteerism becomes the leverage.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We've got to have volunteers that fuel the programmatic effort of the church. And what I'm trying to say is programs never reproduce to give you the leverage of more growth. What programs do is they consume. What do they consume? They consume volunteer hours. And the insanity of the system in its current form is every hour we consume for our agenda of volunteerism to run the institutional growth part is time and energy and equipping that those same volunteers are not getting to learn and practice relational disciple making beyond that attractional side of the church.
Which would grow deeper disciples, like you said, like quantity, quality, deeper quality, probably multiply quicker, probably in the long run, reach more people.
Right.
But that takes time. It's not pragmatic. Like all those things, you know.
It's not the, what it is it's outside the comfort level of the current way of doing it. If we go back to that model that you and I are going to start the church, that's going to start 20 churches over 20 years, and we're going to do it on a relational disciple making growth engine and mission. You and I probably aren't starting out as full-time paid pastors with a building or a mortgage debt or a, you know, we're probably not taking the path of the very first thing we're going to do is find donors to fund what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start out in coffee shops, relationally doing the 3-year thing Jesus did.
Right. And somehow you got to pay those bills.
And you got to pay the bills. And it's probably not going to start by digging yourself the rut of needing to fund. Your very first priority is, how do I fund myself full time for a year? Just think the stewardship of it. At the end of the day, how does the accountability of the stewardship of starting from scratch on a full time salary work if relational disciple making is the mission and the ism to success?
Well, now we need the retirees to jump in.
That's the whole art. Now, if we jump outside the vocational ministry box, it's the army of people. How do you mobilize the army of people that don't need the full-time paycheck or are willing to do for less of a paycheck? You and I had the conversation offline that when we're trying to move the needle on the operating system, for those of us that are already vocational pastors inside the system, we're trying to figure out if we want to buck the operating system and do this different operating system. We're in a scarcity mindset of how do we get the bills paid? But if we can step out of that and go to the boomer retirement villages with people 55 to 70 who are active and thriving and doing something with their time and they don't need a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
Or the young millennial who, yeah, they don't have their act together, but they're willing to get a paid salary 4 days of the week and give a day a week of their time. If we can get to outside the full-time paid vocational box and think about the army of people that exist in this country, that we get creative, they don't have to overcome the stigma of how do I get outside the system? We got to figure out how to give them the new operating system that they can run and thrive with. And the problem is those of us inside the system are the gatekeeper. And the first part of the gatekeeper is the elephant in the room of money.
Yeah. That sounds an awful lot like the priesthood of all believers. It sounds an awful lot like the pastorals, the older investing in the younger, like all those things could be kind of deinstitutionalized and made a lot more relational and natural in a way that would probably be a lot more effective. So tell us a little bit more about the operating system. We've talked kind of like the importance of definitions. So how are you defining that?
Yeah, I think a simple way to think about it is as church leaders, if I can just talk to church leaders for a minute, we don't think in terms of operating systems. It's not how we see things. We think in terms of models. We think in terms of, I'm using the fill in the blank. I'm using the multi-site model. I'm using the purpose-driven model. I'm using the house church model. And if you do the analogy now to computers or phones, you have an operating system on a computer or a phone, and you have apps and programs, which are like the models. And if you think about how the operating system on your computer compares to the software programs or apps on your computer. Let's start with the operating system inside, you never see it. You don't even know what it is. It's ones and zeros inside the computer. You never see the operating system. What you do is you feel the impact of how that operating system constrains the different programs that run on your computer. It sets the rules for how the programs work. We spend equivalently now as church leaders, we don't go spend a lot of time working on the operating system. We inherit the operating system from somebody and we focus on the model or the program. Oh, I can see my Microsoft Word or my boy, I sure wish my Word had this other thing on it because I can see it. I wish it was over here doing it differently. We spend our whole ministry lives focused on tweaking the evolution of those programs or models. And when we finally get fed up with the model's not giving me what I want, I like that other better looking model, we just switch models or we try a new model, never recognizing that there's actually an operating system that's what's constrained. It might be the very reason I'm getting frustrated with the model is not the model. It's the constraint that the operating system's putting on the model. I think if we could just, if we could somehow all go to the 100,000 foot level and look down on the last 40 years of the American church growth movement, there is absolutely an operating system that is at work inside the church. And it is literally controlling. And this is where I don't care if you're doing a micro church, a house church, a multi-site church, an urban church, a parachute drop church, a suburban church, there is an operating system that is controlling the specific model that you're using. And the definition of insanity is to try to keep changing that model and tweaking and evolving that model to get results that the operating system will never let you get. We can say, man, I want a simple, reproducible model that can reproduce and multiply. Let's just say that's our goal. We're getting ready to start it. We want a model that's simple and minimal and reproducible and it can multiply. Guess what? The current operating system only delivers an institutional programmatic approach to growth. That doesn't equal a simple, reproducible thing that can multiply because a program can never reproduce. It can only consume. So if the current underlying operating system that controls our models, the prevailing models, is going to give us an institutional programmatic growth engine, we're kidding ourselves to think it's going to give us reproduction. Look, on the church planting side, less than 7% of U.S. churches right now reproduce. And here's the really bad news. The majority of the 7% that are reproducing, guess how they're reproducing? They're reproducing programmatically. They're not reproducing because organically people, disciples who make disciples, rise up to plant churches. They plant churches because the lead pastor decided it's what we're going to be about. So program, we're tithing to church planting. We have a residency program. And all those are good. Don't take them away. We need more churches doing it. But the truth is the majority of churches that are reproducing right now are reproducing programmatically through effort. And what happens if the lead pastor or one or two key people die or go away? You could have a church that's doing a whole bunch of church planting and all of a sudden you lose the lead person.
Yeah.
Because it's programmatic, you stop church planting.
When I was a kid, I used to want to draw a cartoon. And so I would try. And then I realized that every cartoon idea I could possibly had was a Far Side cartoon that I had seen like within the last 2 years. It's like, you just couldn't escape it. You know, it was like deep down in your bones, that homeostasis or like that gravity that pulls you back. It's like even trying to like escape velocity at NASA. It's like you're trying to get out of orbit. You're trying to get out of gravity into orbit, right? And you have got to get 19,000 miles an hour, whatever it is. It takes a lot of power, like a lot of direction, intentionality, focus, power, fuel to get to escape velocity. But otherwise, you just keep falling back to earth, right? Like that gravity just keeps pulling you back. So even if you start a new church, the constant temptation, like we do house church planting, and it's like, what are you going to do with the kids? Okay, maybe we should start something for the kids. What are you going to do with the teens? Should we start something for the teens? There's just that constant call back to programmatic, because that's just what's in your bones.
Yeah. And the reason for that, Matt, if you just mathematically for a second, if we did a graph of the graph is along one axis is time, and up the other axis is number of people we're reaching. So number of people we're reaching versus time. What we all want is this exponential curve moving up and to the right, or at least a curve that keeps moving up and to the right. Unfortunately, in math, there is a physical principle in the creation of the world called an asymptote. And an asymptote is a natural barrier that something runs into. So it starts increasing and it slows down and starts reaching a barrier or a limit. And here's what you either learn how to break through that barrier or you get the bell curve of life. You go up, you hit that barrier, and then you start going down and you literally get the bell curve of life, birth, growth, death. What we do in churches, and it's the entire, in the church growth movement, an entire industry of consultants and services have emerged to help us break through the asymptotic growth barriers. In church, there's a 200 barrier, a 500 barrier, a 1200 barrier, a 2000 barrier. And guess what? Every time you figure out how to break a barrier, and it's programmed, this is the deal. You're breaking it programmatically.
Mm-hmm.
And the promise that you have when you break that growth barrier is the next asymptote barrier is waiting for you. There's always a sideways energy that it's a manual labor of effort of how do we get this growth institutionally and programmatically. If you really think through the lens of consultants, and I'm not bashing consultants, I'm saying, we need them to get through barriers, but most every consulting service you can think about involves a growth barrier or growth opportunity and some dimension of how you tweak, modify, manhandle, leverage the programmatic institutional process of growth.
Sure. And they have to do that, right? Because if you were to say, hey, your operating system is all wrong and your whole operating system needs to look like this. And this, we hired you to make us grow and now we're getting smaller. Like it's not, we're not getting.
Take that and think, why don't we see significant progress in the disciple making consulting industry? Why aren't there, name the top three disciple making consultant agencies that are killing it with churches. And there's one reason why you can't name it or find it. It's because relational disciple-making Jesus-style way would really require a consultant to cause that church to change their operating system. And instead what happens, we hire consultants to tweak our models.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And there's no tweaking we're going to do to the current models that are constrained by the current operating system that are going to give us the result we want. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, Ronald Heifetz talks about productive tension. It's like kind of like the frog in the pot. You know, you turn up too hot, he's out, not enough, not cooked. And nobody wants the heat turned up too high, right? Nobody, but we all want the change, but we don't want it too high. It's like you're kind of just stuck in that spot. And what I hear you saying is that it's going to take new efforts to get to 16%.
I would say, I'll just talk for me personally. You know, every year I get older, I got one less year to make a difference in things. And I want to see the 16. I want to see both the disciple-making culture and church planting as a normative measure of success in the church, which means we got to get to the 16% tipping point. I don't think you get there. I don't think you get to the 16% number on either of those things. And they're related. You can't take away the disciple-making culture from the church planting culture. They're intertwined. I don't see us making any significant dent in progress of moving the disciple-making culture from 4 to 16 or the church planting one from 7 to 16 without some major effort at a minimum to put a new operating system in place that's not constraining things the way it is now in our new churches.
Okay, talk to us about that.
I'm suggesting we go blow up and replace all 320,000 churches, but we're kidding ourselves if we just keep planting churches using an old, incapable of creating a disciple-making culture operating system into our new churches. We got to start by getting new operating systems into new churches, and that's going to require existing churches to engage the conversation in a way that even though they may not blow up their operating system, they've got a front row seat to equipping. It may require literally churches that have the institutional programmatic engine to start sending the energetic, experienced youth pastor to plant a new church using a new operating system for the sole purpose of that church getting a front row seat to seeing some new unconstrained operating system things happening.
Yes. Talk to us about a little bit about what that looks like, because this is something you've spent a lot of time working on.
Yeah. I think there's my motive's the 16%, but there is a general consensus out there. If you go on the church planting side, go talk with network and denominational leaders coming out of COVID, and there's a general consensus that we're spending more effort, which means money, time, energy, to get less result, and we're not sure we're happy about the product we're getting. Hmm. And so with that in mind, we started an initiative a couple of years ago to pull together a bunch of networks and denominations and just look at the idea of, let's dissect and understand the current operating system. Since pastors don't normally think in terms of operating system, what are the elements? How do you draw a picture of the current operating system, since an operating system is usually something you can't see? And so where we are, Matt, is a really good effort went into that with, I think, 30 plus networks and denominations. We're in the middle of piloting with a 12 to 15 churches right now, our first round of piloting some of the principles of operating system. Now, the intent is to go through three rounds of piloting because we're learning that the idea that the operating system is so ornery, even when we bring planters into this pilot initiative, who are willing to be bivocational, co-vocational, do micro, get some financially liberated engines. The people who are overseeing them, who are sending them, are so deeply rooted in the current paradigm that it's very difficult to get away from the current thing. So we're going to go through multiple rounds of piloting. I'm using this experience, and as an engineer at heart, I've been working for a year on a book, which is dissecting the current operating system. So I've identified 10 dilemmas that all work together to create the paralysis we have in the current operating system. But our goal was to focus on the positive future. How do we start planting churches with a new operating system? Now, here's what's fascinating, just to throw it out there, is we identified six different elements or areas that seem to be, no matter what model you would end up using, here's six elements that when you're talking about church, we better figure out how to use those six elements to land on a model. And so the six include, and we really tried to root them in looking at international movements and just biblically for sure. Let me give you the first kind of, this isn't going to sound profound, but I'm telling you it is profound. You look internationally at movements, and you know this, disciple making movements, you don't see disciple making or church planting movements that aren't everywhere around them bathed in prayer and fasting. So let's now jump to the U.S. context of starting churches. We don't start with 3 to 6 months of prayer and fasting for a planter. We start with them inheriting the institutional programmatic model, we're going to give them money. And now what do they got to do? They got to get that church launched by a certain date to get the tithes and offerings up to, it's like a bridge loan on a capital campaign. We got a 2 to 3 year window to get this thing up and running, which pushes us into the institutional programmatic path. So element number one is the role of the Holy Spirit or the prayer and fasting, listening. What am I doing before I just inherit the next thing to hear what God is saying to me about the unique context of what I'm going to do? A second element of the six, I'm not going to go through them all right now, but a second element is, what is our growth engine? What's the growth engine that we're going to have in whatever this thing is we're starting, whether it's a workplace ministry, a mission, a church plant? What is our growth engine? A third issue is, what's the economic engine? How does the economic engine in this work? And here's the fascinating part. These six elements, each element has two or three questions to it. So that means there's 12 to 15 questions. And what you can do with these six elements and the 12 questions, we can produce just about any model being used in America right now by how you answer those 12 questions. In other words, reverse engineer it. You want to see a purpose-driven church model? Okay, answer the 12 questions this way. You want to see a house church model? Answer the 12 questions this way.
Now, are those value questions or practical, like, execution kind of questions?
It's a bridging of both.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a bridging of both. So let me give you an example. In the financial engine, what's the financial engine? So in finances, there's what's called liberated financial engines, and there's non-liberated financial engines. A liberated financial engine is what in a lot of international movements. There's not a direct correlation to the amount of money being spent by how many people are being reached. You liberate the conversion rate from the finances being spent. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Now jump to the current prevailing model in the U.S. church. It's a non-liberated financial engine. Tell me where you want to plant and tell me how many people you want to reach, and then I'll tell you how much money you have to spend to do that. Because it's an institutional programmatic model. It's going to be driven by full-time staff people with buildings, with programs. So in a given geographic area, a white suburban area somewhere, there's a certain dollar figure of what it's going to cost to go into an urban center. The dollar number's higher to reach the same amount of people, but there's an average for any given model. On the economic engine, one of the questions is, do you want a liberated or a non-liberated financial engine? And don't answer the question too quick, because the answer is profound. Okay, but go back to the question of what's your growth engine? What is your growth engine? If your growth engine is relational style disciple making, Jesus way, and your economic engine is a liberated financial engine, guess what? That doesn't equate to how we're planting churches right now.
Yeah.
It's going to give you something different. Now, the strength of this approach, if we come back to an operating system that you can't normally see, you can reverse engineer and say, okay, if I want to get this, then I've got to answer the questions this way. Let me tell you how ornery the operating system is. The order that you ask the 12 questions gives you different models. It isn't just a matter of asking the questions. So this first pilot cohort of planters we put through, for the first 3 months of prayer and fasting that we put them into for the listing mode, number one, that 3 months was painful for most of them. They're not used to, we're Westerners that want to jump into action. The idea that I got to slow down and spend 3 months of prayer and fasting is really hard. But what we had them do in the 3 months of prayer and fasting is we gave them the list of questions. And each time we'd give it to them, I think three times, we ask them to answer the questions in different orders. In each questions, at some point, this aha goes off in your mind when you say, oh, I want a relational disciple making approach and I want a liberated financial engine. Okay. The ramifications of that in terms of what you've got to turn around and do in the model that you put in place.
Yeah, it's huge.
Is huge.
Yeah.
Wow. It's hard for me not to take this very personal.
I want to come back to what we said earlier. This isn't about bashing what we're doing or deconstructing what we're doing.
Oh, no, no. I meant that in the most positive sense.
Yeah. The mystery of how God uses everything we're doing in a positive way.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, it just speaks deep into my soul. And the other part of this are the values, right? So the guardrails that you talked about in the last session and the competing value systems of the institutional programmatic church versus relational disciple making or the church kind of church. So just like out of curiosity, I know we're kind of reaching near the end of our time here. You start a church that's a relational disciple making core church, and then needs come up, and our knee jerk reaction is programs, right? So, you know, all of a sudden all that shifts to relationality. It's like, well, somebody needs food. Okay. Well, you know them. Are you going to give them food, or do we create a pantry, or, you know, like how do we not get back to where we started?
And again, we're not going through all the elements, but holistically, let me just suggest that the six elements of an operating, these aren't like go find them in the Bible, because the Bible doesn't have an operating system with elements. Mm-hmm. But so we're trying to discern a man-made model here. But the six elements, they should be able to holistically integrate in a way that when you ask that question, you can point at one of the elements.
Okay.
Say, how are we doing? And the element that this one would point to is mobilization.
Okay.
The issue of how are people being mobilized for good works and deeds on their calling for the purpose of disciple making.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. What is there any other thoughts you want to share before we wrap up?
No, I'm just grateful, Matt, for the conversation. I'm grateful for discipleship.org and the role that they're playing. I think the upcoming discipleship forum is on the culture of disciple making. That conversation, that's why we did this in two parts. Our first part, if people didn't watch it, go back and see it, is on this problem statement of less than 4% of U.S. churches have a disciple making culture. What is culture? Why do we have that problem? That conversation is inseparable from this conversation about the operating system. We can't keep hoping to see a different outcome on what we're doing by just tweaking models that are constrained by a flawed operating system.
It's like I'm going to take my Toyota Corolla and tweak the engine to do like NASCAR or something.
That's right. And now there's tweaks we can do to whatever car we have to make them perform better and get better gas mileage or be fast. And that's what we spend our time doing.
Yeah.
But in reality, if what we're really needing to do is be in a NASCAR race, but we've got a Toyota Corolla, we may have to think about switching cars. That's the operating system.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful that discipleship.org is really engaging this conversation. I want to encourage anybody that's engaged in or intrigued by the conversation of culture and operating system, the discipleship forum in May is where you need to be. I'm going to be there, and I would welcome having some conversations. In fact, I'll be leading some Q&A and things on what we're talking about there. So I would look forward to seeing you.
Links in the description, link to Renew Movement in the description. Appreciate your time, Todd. You're always a blessing.
Thank you, Matt.
Check out the link in the show notes to find out more information about Renew Movement. And I want to invite you, if I haven't already, to the National Disciple Making Forum this May 1st and 2nd in Indianapolis. Go to discipleship.org and buy your tickets ASAP, because they're selling fast and the event is literally right around the corner. If you're enjoying what you're hearing on this podcast, please hit the subscribe button, come back, and listen to more episodes on the discipleship.org podcast. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for being a listener, and I hope that you enjoy the rest of your day. We'll see you.